When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Today we have a listener request we have gotten a few times before, most recently from Maggie back in April, and that is the London Match Girls Strike of 1888. This is an event I had heard of. Had you heard of it?
Oh, yes.
Yes. I knew it was really important to labor rights history in Britain.
Yeah.
That was the sum of my knowledge.
Mine doesn't go far past that.
Right. My knowledge was so limited that I thought these girls who were striking were girls who sold matches.
That's because of the sad Christmas song, I would bet.
Well, I know it more as a sad Christmas story with sad illustrations.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's not. Nope. It's not about girls who sold matches.
No.
And most of them, some of them are women. Some of them are girls. The girl who, they made the matches. So that's just to clear up the first misconception. And this is not quite as jovial a story as maybe the tone of what we just said might make it sound like.
Yeah.
It's got some parts in it that are hard.
As much of history does, sadly.
Yep.
So we're going to talk first a little bit about life in East London, because even today the name the East End still conjures images of poverty. And writer Charles Dickens died more than a decade, slightly less than two decades before the event that we're talking about today took place. But he was one of the most famous writers to write about the Victorian East End of London. So think about Oliver Twist and you will kind of get where we're going with this. The East End as a term for this neighborhood was actually coined near the end of the 1700s. But it was really in the 1880s that it started to take on a more insulting connotation, synonymous with poverty, overcrowding, illness, and crime.
In 1889, a book called Labor and Life of the People basically surveyed and mapped East and South London, chronicling the incidents of poverty and how people lived in these neighborhoods. And from a review of the book is this quote, quote, "Much has been written of late about the squalor and vice of East London and of that seemingly vast horde, the army of the unemployed. Most realistic pictures of starving mothers and naked children have filled the newspapers." And that's the end of the quote. So even though the book itself reported that a lot of people living in East and South London had their basic day-to-day needs met, like they had enough to eat as kind of a minimum standard, the area was notorious, even at this time that we're talking about, for being synonymous with poverty and crime.
And this so-called outcast London didn't have its reputation simply because of the income level and living conditions of its residents. Many of the area's residents were immigrants and minorities, regarded with a certain degree of suspicion and disdain by much of middle and upper class Britain.
Another culprit for the East End's reputation was the industries that were headquartered there. Many of them were so-called sweating industries, so the types of places where people worked long hours in windowless rooms doing work that was sometimes dangerous and often looked down upon by the people in the more affluent occupations. One of these employers was Bryant and May Match Company. Most matchmakers at this time were young women, and in the hierarchy of working poor in Victorian England, these so-called match girls tended to be some of the lowest of the low. People really looked down on girls who made matches and women who made matches.
In 1888, the Bryant and May match factories came to the attention of Annie Besant. Most American pronunciations of this seem to rhyme with Crescent, so we're going with that. She was a socialist feminist reformer who, by this point, had been advocating for social change for decades. In the 1870s, she had edited the National Reformer, along with Charles Bradlaugh, which advocated for things like labor rights, women's suffrage, and birth control. And that last one got the two of them tried for obscenity, but they were acquitted.
Besant was also a member of the Fabian Society, founded in 1884. The Fabian Society is a socialist organization established to advocate nonviolent political change, and in particular to try to establish Great Britain as a democratic socialist state. Some of the other famous members in the Fabian Society's early years were George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, and Beatrice and Sidney Webb. The Fabian Society helped form Britain's Labour Party in 1906 and has continued to be affiliated with the Labour Party since then.
On June 15th, the Bryant and May Match Factory was discussed at a Fabian Society meeting following a presentation by trade unionist Clementina Black. The topic of the conversation was the fact that shareholders in the factory received a dividend of more than 20%. However, the employees who made its boxes were paid 2.25 pence or pennies per gross for their work. So to catch folks up really briefly on British money at the time, there were 12 pence in a shilling and 20 shillings in a pound. So this was basically nothing. The members of the society pledged not to use Bryant and May matches or to buy any products from them.
Besant wanted to investigate this a little further, so she went to the factory to talk to these workers herself. They weren't, however, actually the same people that had been discussed at the meeting. Those people who were making the 2.25 pence for every 144 boxes, those are people that worked at home, often with their whole families making boxes as fast as possible. Besant met workers instead leaving from their shift. These were people who did things in the factory itself, doing jobs like taking the matches off of the frames and putting them into their boxes. And the conditions that these people described to her were pretty appalling.
On June 23, 1888, she published the findings of her investigation in The Link, a journal for the servants of man. Some of Bryant and May's match girls were as young as 8 years old. Many were immigrants from Ireland whose families had moved to London in the wake of the famine earlier in the century. In the summer, they started work at 6:30 in the morning and in the winter at 8 a.m. And either way, the workday ended at 6 p.m., although in other accounts, the days were often as long as 14 hours.
I found a lot of sources citing the 14-hour number, which is a little longer than was described in this particular article that sparked this whole thing. Apart from these really long days, all of the work was done standing, and the workers whose job was emptying the frames of their matches also had to run up and down flights of stairs every time they needed a new frame, because they were only allowed one frame at a time in their working station. So this meant that they had to run up and down the stairs about 3 times an hour.
And they were running because all but a few married women were paid by the piece, not by the day or by the hour. So the more work they did, the more money they got paid.
Because the pay for each unit was tiny, for example, 3/4 pence per gross for filling boxes of matches, they were really motivated to work as quickly as humanly possible.
Because most of Bryant and May's products were strike-anywhere matches, which, as their names suggest, can be struck anywhere. This led to problems of your work spontaneously catching fire while you were handling strike-anywhere matches as fast as you possibly could.
But the employees at the factory didn't get to take home all of their minimal pay. There was this long list of out-of-pocket costs in which the workers had to pay for the tools that they needed to do their jobs. On top of that, there were fines. These are some of the fines the workers Besson interviewed reported.
Dirty feet, 3 pence.
Leaving the area around the bench untidy, 3 pence.
I want to clarify that the bench in this situation is like the table or the counter that they're working on. It was not a seat that you sat on. Putting matches that had burned up during work onto the bench, 1 or 2 shillings.
Leaving matches on the bench while going to get a fresh frame, 3 pence.
Talking, 3 pence.
Being late, the loss of half a day's pay. This was due to not being allowed in to work, and a further fine of 5 pence.
Yeah, so if you were late, you lost your pay until, like, the break in the day where they would let you in. And then you also had to pay a fine on top of your lost pay. Workers whose matches caught fire while they were working, which happened a lot because these were strike-anywhere matches being handled very quickly, they basically watched their pay burn up in front of them because all that work they were doing was now gone. And then if the frames were damaged in the fire, they could be fined or sacked.
Besson also described one girl who had been fined for letting the web that was used to make the matches wrap around a machine. She had done this because her fingers were about to be caught, and she was told, quote, never mind your fingers. Even so, another employee had lost a finger in just such an incident and had been given absolutely no support from the company while she recovered.
To add insult to injury and something that could just go into a bad management journal as an example of what not to do, Besson also reported that Mr. Theodore Bryant of Bryant and May had decided to show his respect to Prime Minister William Gladstone by putting up a statue of him at the factory. And he docked a shilling from every worker's pay to pay for the statue that would go in their work area. And then he gave them half a day off without pay as a holiday to celebrate the unveiling of the statue they'd had to pay for themselves.
Want to make grumbly noises. Besson ends her report, quote, such is a bald account of one form of white slavery as it exists in London. With chattel slaves, Mr. Bryant could not have made his huge fortune, for he could not have fed, clothed, and housed them for 4 shillings a week each, and they would have had a definite money value which would have served as a protection. But who cares for the fate of these white wage slaves? Born in slums, driven to work while still children, undersized because underfed, oppressed because helpless, flung aside as soon as worked out, who cares if they die or go on the streets, provided only that the Bryant and May shareholders get their 23% and Mr. Theodore Bryant can erect statues and buy parks. Oh, if we had but a people's Dante to make a special circle in the inferno for those who live on this misery and suck wealth out of the starvation of helpless girls. Failing a poet to hold up their conduct to the execration of posterity, enshrined in deathless verse, let us strive to touch their consciences, i.e. their pockets, and let us at least avoid being partakers of their sins by abstaining from using their commodities.
And with that call to action to boycott Bryant and May, we will take a brief word to talk about a sponsor.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
To get back to our story, unsurprisingly, the Bryant and May Match Company, which was at this point the largest matchmaker in Britain, was not happy at all by Annie Besant's report in The Link. They immediately started trying to strong-arm their employees into denying that the allegations were true. On July 4th, an anonymous worker wrote a letter to Annie Besant that said in part, quote, "They have been trying to get all the poor girls to say that it is all lies that has been printed and trying to make us sign papers that it is all lies."
On July 5th, 1888, about 200 workers walked off the job. Soon, about 1,200 of the Bryant and May employees who made Strike Anywhere matches had gone on strike, and another 300 who worked in the nearby wax match factory joined them.
Accounts at the time were all over the place about exactly why they had stopped their work on that particular day. According to one account, they were just tired of all the fines and poor working conditions. In another, two women had been fired for talking to Annie Besant about her investigation. And in a third, it was one young woman who had been fired for not following a foreman's orders to fill a matchbox in a particular way. But her friends at the factory had thought her firing was unfair. And it was this last explanation that Bryant and May tried to claim when talking to the press.
And for decades, this strike was positioned mostly as Annie Besant's work. But she wasn't particularly involved in it. In Victorian England, strikes did not have a good track record of leading to reforms for workers. So Besant thought the best course of action would be to press consumers to boycott Bryant and May, which they did. Most of her involvement with the strike itself was through raising funds and spreading the word. Donors included Frederick Engels, and George Bernard Shaw became a clerk for the fundraising effort.
The striking workers themselves were really the ones who actually organized the strike and the protests that went along with it. They ultimately formed the Union of Women Matchmakers, which was the largest union of women and girls in Britain. They formed a picket line. They arranged demonstrations and meetings with speakers at Mile End Waste, which was a nearby open area. And Mile End Waste also served as the meeting point to distribute donations to the people who needed them. About 50 workers went directly to Parliament to discuss their grievances directly in person with the MPs.
Overall, the striking workers really got a lot of support. One reason was that Annie Besant was quite good at the publicity side of it. She had titled her original article on their working conditions, White Slavery in London, and had closely tied the idea of these women's terrible pay and poor working conditions to the idea of chattel slavery. Britain had abolished slavery more than 50 years prior, so the idea that there was slavery going on right there in the East End really horrified a lot of Victorian London. Even though, to be clear, what was happening at the match factory was definitely not chattel slavery. That was just a comparison that she had very articulately drawn.
Yeah, I wanted to point that out because there are definitely cases where people continue to use slavery as like a one-to-one direct parallel with things that were not slavery. So this was terrible. It was not chattel slavery. The striking women also got the support of some of London's skilled trade unions, including the London Trades Council. The LTC had traditionally shunned the needs of unskilled labor. They represented skilled workers, and so pretty much all of the unskilled labor in Britain, they were pretty much on their own. But in this case, it stepped in and tried to negotiate with Bryant and May on behalf of the striking workers. Initially, the factory refused to budge, saying only that if the women returned to work, all but the ringleaders could have their jobs back.
But the support was definitely not universal. There is a widely quoted piece from the Times, quote, "The pity is that the match girls have not been suffered to take their own course, but have been egged on to strike by irresponsible advisors. No effort has been spared by those pests of the modern industrialized world to bring this quarrel to a head."
I tried really hard to figure out exactly, like, this quote comes up again and again in stuff about the strike. And I'm like, okay, what is the context of this piece in the Times? This is a quote that somebody said that the Times printed, or was like an editorial in the Times?
Right.
Like, what actually, what was it? But I did not find the answer to that. Soon, social settlement organization Toynbee Hall was investigating, and a boycott was rolling through the consumer market, and bad press was putting an extreme amount of pressure on Bryant and May. So after about 2 weeks, the company started negotiating with the strikers. That negotiation started on July 16th, and an agreement was reached the next day. Bryant and May, insisting to the press that they surely would have addressed any complaints if only they had known that anyone was unhappy about anything, rehired all of the striking workers.
I feel like that's like a model that has happened so many times throughout history when companies are like, we didn't know anybody was miserable in their incredibly cruel jobs. Don't people love that? They're fine.
Nobody said anything was a problem. Nobody said it was a problem that we were docking them 3 pence for dirty feet and not paying them anything and like making them run up and down stairs with strike anywhere matches.
They had no idea they were unhappy. As a result of the negotiations, all of the fines were abolished, as well as all deductions from the workers' pay for the tools they needed to do their job. There were also pay adjustments, and a policy was instituted in which grievances could be taken to the managing director rather than having to go through the foreman. And the union had to stay to advocate for the workers.
One last concession that the strikers got was the establishment of a breakfast room. And the breakfast room was enormously important for reasons that we will talk about after another brief sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
So one of the things that we haven't really talked about in terms of the Bryant and May workers' workplace hazards was risks to their health. In addition to all the things Besant documented in her report, women working in matchstick factories were susceptible to a condition known as Fossey jaw, sometimes described at the time as phosphorus poisoning. And this was because the Strike Anywhere matches that they were making used white phosphorus, sometimes also called yellow phosphorus, and exposure to white phosphorus can cause osteonecrosis, which is the death of bone tissue.
Here are the symptoms of Fossey jaw. Swelling, tooth pain, swollen gums, swollen cheeks and jaws, tooth decay, decay of the jaw bones, festering sores that it's exposed the decaying bone, necrotic gangrenous tissue in the face and jaw, and death up to 20% of the time.
Bryant and May were, in fact, using half of all the yellow phosphorus in the entire matchmaking industry. And this was a departure from its original business plan, which was to use red phosphorus, which does not cause osteonecrosis, to make those strike-on-the-box matches. These were more expensive, which made strike-anywhere matches much more popular.
Often, workers who found themselves displaying the early symptoms of this condition would try to hide it, because they knew that the factory, trying to protect its own interests, would fire them if it found out that they were sick.
One of the reasons that a separate space for food and eating was so important to the strike negotiations was that without one, Bryant and May workers had to bring their meals with them, keep them next to their work area, and then sometimes eat at their workbenches. Eating in the working area, with the food having also been stored there in the working area, increased their phosphorus exposure dramatically.
Another thing we haven't talked about, which is a total surprise to me to learn,
is that William Bryant and Francis May, founders of Bryant and May Match Company, were Quakers. And based on literally any other time we have ever talked about Quakers in the podcast ever, this might come as a surprise to people. They had founded the business in 1850, and in 1863, the Commission on the Employment of Children in Industry investigated their business and found it to be, quote, a very nicely conducted place. In 1861, though, Wilberforce Bryant, William Bryant's oldest son, became the general manager there. He wanted to expand the business as much as possible over the objections of Francis May. The younger Bryant forced May out in 1875, following the threat of a lawsuit that May was afraid would tarnish the reputation of the Quaker religion. Obviously, May's quiet departure from the company did not have the effect he was hoping for at all, because without his more tempering influence, the sons of William Bryant took the business in a very different and a much more exploitive direction. A lot of the pay and working conditions that the striking workers were advocating to change had actually been illegal for years following the passage of the Factory Acts in Britain.
For a couple of years after the strike, Bryant and May tried to restore its reputation as being a socially minded employer, as was expected of a Quaker business. It took a more fair, but perhaps somewhat paternal, approach to its workers. It also made charitable contributions to organizations that would benefit the people who worked there, who continued to be quite poor. Soon, the press were describing Bryant and May as a model employer, offering jobs to British workers and looking after the poor ladies who worked there.
Okay, they were doing things like donating lots of food to the soup kitchens where the people who worked for them ate from time to time because they weren't being paid enough to buy food elsewhere. It's a little unclear whether the Bryant sons continued to identify as Quakers or not. I found contradictory evidence on that. But regardless, this more philanthropic but sometimes definitely paternalistic way of running their business did not last. The Star reported a case of Fossey Jaw at the factory in 1892. A subsequent investigation found numerous safety issues with how phosphorus was being handled there. And then 10 years after the strike, Bryant and May appeared in court following the death of one of their workers from phosphorus poisoning. And it was revealed that the factory had 17 unreported cases of phosphorus poisoning, which by law had to be reported to health authorities whenever they occurred. Bryant and May had not only failed to report these cases, but had also actively concealed the fact that they had even happened, and 6 people had died. They were fined £25.09. I laugh out of sadness because that does not sound like a lot of money,
exactly,
even in late 19th century dollars. The company ultimately had to merge with other matchmakers to stay afloat because their reputation could not really recover.
And this strike of 1888 led to increased awareness of the dangers of working with yellow phosphorus and a push to ban its use. In 1891, the Salvation Army opened a competing match factory using only red phosphorus and paid double what Bryant and May did.
Bryant and May stopped using yellow phosphorus in 1901. The International Association of Labor Legislation began advocating a global ban on yellow phosphorus in matchmaking in the early 1900s as well. An international agreement was signed in 1908, and Britain banned the import, sale, or manufacture of white phosphorus matches in 1910. Strike anywhere matches seem incredibly dangerous to me.
Yeah.
And so it surprised me as I was reading this that the people favored the cheapness of the strike anywhere matches over the safety of a match that does not just light on fire against anything.
Right. With the most minor friction.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And this strike also had a huge influence on organized labor in Britain. Following the success of the matchworker strike, there was a move toward unionizing among other unskilled labor all across the nation. It grew into the new unionism movement, and as we alluded to earlier, it eventually led to the establishment of the Independent Labor Party.
Yeah, prior to this, as we said earlier, strikes hadn't traditionally been very successful in getting workers changes in their working environment in the time right around this. And this, the success of this strike shifted that a little bit. And the idea of unskilled labor having a union became a much bigger deal, because before that, most of the unions were about more skilled trades, and the people who were working in unskilled jobs, a lot of times with basically no protections, weren't really seen as being worthy of being in a union, and that changed after this point. Yeah.
Is your listener mail peppy this time around?
It's pretty peppy, yeah. Annie Besant was also a really interesting person, and she went on to do other things completely unrelated to this strike. And originally, as I started researching, this article or this podcast was going to be a lot more about her. And then I realized that it's a really a big misperception that the strike was all her doing.
Right.
A lot of the writing about the strike for decades was pretty dismissive and judgmental about the women who were striking, and sort of made it like they were unruly children who were goaded into a successful strike by the heroic work of Annie Besant. And that was not true at all.
No, they were on it. They were organized.
Yeah, they really, they had a whole lot of solidarity, and they organized a bunch of stuff, and they got things that they were after, which included not being forced to pay for their own work tools to do their work that they were making almost no money for. So anyway, now I'll get to the much more cheery listener mail. This listener mail is from Allie. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because she said that she had written to us really recently, and she's writing again because she just listened to the episode on Anne, Bonnie, and Mary Read. And so she says, I just had to write in again after yesterday's Anne, Bonnie, and Mary Read episode because guess what? I'm a pirate historian.
Yay!
And boy, do I feel your pain when it comes to a general history of the pirates. Although my own history with pirates really begins a long time ago when my mom, an anthropologist, and my dad, a marine archaeologist who brought the first emerald up from the shipwreck Atocha, instilled me and my brother with an early love for pirates by teaching us how to say something I'm not going to repeat because it has a word we don't normally say on the show as small children. It is a very piratey saying, though. I'll start with grad school. When I first entered my history program, I had no idea what I wanted to study, which put me way behind the rest of my classmates. At the beginning, a lot of them introduced themselves with either a specific period or a region of interest where I would go, I'm Allie, and I guess I like pirates. Before too long, my wonderful advisor helped me hammer out a primary field with a little more specificity, which ended up being Atlantic piracy from 1500 to 1750 with a focus on British and Spanish perspectives. But it was rough getting there, and part of that is absolutely the fault of a general history. Originally, I had wanted to focus on Atlantic pirates and gender, using Anne, Bonnie, Mary Read, and other pirate women as specific examples of the masculine image of pirates, but that very quickly proved to be impossible. There really is just not enough evidence of Read and Bonnie to do anything with them in a scholarly fashion, or at least nothing new, because plenty of scholars, Marcus Rediker is the first to come to mind, have tried. They always end up being these kind of weird, nebulous examples you can only talk about theoretically, so they end up being much more interesting and almost a fictional sense than a real one. I had to abandon gender and pirates pretty quickly. Though that remains a facet of piracy that I am still very interested in. And so then Allie goes on to recommend as a future episode topic a podcast on Captain William Kidd, because I'm going to read this bit. In the end, I focused on the fine line between pirates and privateers using Captain William Kidd as a primary example. Kidd is also in a general history in a much romanticized fashion, and like pretty much everybody who studies pirates, my thesis had to include Johnson's book as more of a reference than a real source. In my bibliography, a general history is even attributed to Daniel Defoe simply because the published version that I had in my personal library listed him as the author and no one else. My advisor and I went back and forth a lot on that point, and I think I mentioned somewhere that a general history probably wasn't written by Defoe, but all in all, that book is sometimes more trouble than it's worth as a scholarly source. It's absolutely responsible for the world's fascination and romanticization of pirates, but its existence makes it twice as hard to verify the facts of piracy because so much of it is based in history that is then embellished beyond recognition. It's a pain, but unfortunately, we can't ignore it either. Thankfully for me, kids' life and death are well documented elsewhere. And if you want to put another pirate on your suggestions list, I highly recommend him, if only for his trial transcripts, which at times are unintentionally hilarious because he continuously interrupts the officials and they hate it. I love these transcripts because documents from pirates themselves simply do not exist. So we pirate historians have to take what we can get from official documents that frequently twist pirates' words to suit their own needs. See The Last Dying Speeches of Pirates and Other Criminals, published on Broadsides. It's pretty rare to see any personality from a pirate in historical documents that isn't a barbaric, profanity-spewing monster. But Kidd's personality is so clear in the transcripts that it's pretty remarkable. If you're interested, they happen to be online. So they're well worth a read. Anyway, this diverged pretty significantly from Bonnie and Reed, so I guess I'll end this note with a thank you. Thank you for tackling a podcast what I couldn't in thesis, and thank you for reminding me why I studied pirates in the first place. I was pretty pirated out by the time I finished grad school, but listening to yesterday's episode reignited my love for these disruptive, romanticized rebels of the sea. Pirate history is a pretty small niche in a wider history of the Atlantic and the Caribbean, but I'm glad part of me knew that's what I wanted to study before the rest of me did. Pirates are pretty great. Thanks again for all you do. Allie, thank you so much, Allie, for reading this, or for sending us this letter.
Yes.
Number one, it's great. Number two, past hosts already did a podcast on Captain William Kidd, which robs me of the chance to read their hilarious court transcripts online, but I might read them anyway for fun someday when I have time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is one that past hosts tackled already, but we will put the link to them in our show notes so other people can read them too. Thank you again so much, Allie. It was so good and actually kind of validating to hear from a pirate historian.
Yeah.
That our perception of a general history of the pirates is pretty right on the money in terms of scholarship. So, if you would like to write to us, we're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook. Well, let me do this the way Holly does it. If you want to come find us on social media, Missed in History is our name. That is our name on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and Instagram. And I might have missed another one, but it's Missed in History pretty much everywhere. And the only thing that is different from Missed in History is our email address, which is historypodcast@howstuffworks.com, because that was our address from way before. You can come to our parent company's website, which is howstuffworks.com, find all kinds of stuff about all kinds of fascinating information. And then you can come to our website, which is missedinhistory.com, where you will find show notes to all of our episodes. I will put the links to these trial transcripts, William Kidd, in there. So you can do all that and a whole lot more at howstuffworks.com or missedinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X, celebrating pride in the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women, creating sustainable size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection, obsessively fit-tested for all-day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit TomboyX.com.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And?
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Hello, iHeart listener. We have a confession to make. Both iHeart and this commercial you're listening to right now would probably sound a heck of a lot better on the new Roku Pro Series TV. It's got side-firing speakers that fill your room with sound, Dolby Atmos audio that puts you right in the middle of the entertainment, and the ability to pair seamlessly with your home theater sound systems that already have surround sound and booming bass. If all that sounds too good to be true, it'll sound even better on the new Roku Pro Series. Your hearing isn't better. Your TV is.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.